Today on Wings, transnational feminist Ninochka Roska.
Intersectionality is not a word for individual liberation. It is a word for collective liberation.
There's a river of birds in migration, a nation of women with wings. There's
Welcome to Wings, a series of news and current affairs programs by and about women around the world, produced and distributed by the Women's International News Gathering Service.
Born and university-educated in the Philippines, Ninochka Roska stood against the Marcos dictatorship, was imprisoned, moved to Hawaii in 1977, and became U.S. representative for the Philippine Left Feminist Organization, Gabriela. With other Filipinas abroad, she developed the U.S. Solidarity Organization, Gabriela Network, or GABNET, which has evolved into a broader transnational feminist organization called AFIRM, spelled AF numeral 3 IRM. Roska is also a celebrated writer of fiction and commentaries. In August 2017, Ninochka Roska spoke by phone from her home in New York to Megan Murphy, founder of the Canada-based multimedia outlet Feminist Current.
Ninochka Roska, can you tell me about your early life? You know, I'm curious as to how you came to activism.
I was born and raised in the Philippines and got both a secular and Catholic education. You know, we're all Catholics in the Philippines, about 85%. So I think the only exceptional thing was when our family was extremely mixed blood, basically Spanish, Malayan, and Chinese. And then there was a huge crowd always in my family house. By crowd, I mean household help. And these people came from different regions and provinces of the country. And so they spoke different languages. We all spoke Tagalog, but they spoke, in addition to that, several other languages, their hometown language, etc., etc. And so I was exposed very early to the pleasures and the hazards of communication, you know, in different languages. Mm-hmm. And then I think there was one seminal incident when I was a kid. The domestics, the help, discovered I could read very early on, around five years old. And so a number of them couldn't. So they, at 1 o'clock in the afternoon, I think twice a week, they would ask me to read to them. They would buy the comics or the weekly fiction magazine, and they would surround me while I read. And it was a very beautiful thing, you know, in the garden, breeze blowing, flowers, trees, and then reading to a group of people. And from that I drew the rather erroneous conclusion that one could make money reading and writing, since the men and women of the neighborhood paid me. You know, they gave me 5 centavos. Each of them gave me 5 centavos. And that was a lot of money for a kid. There, and then we had, my family had a very good library. I don't know why, since nobody read the books except me. And only because I was told, don't touch the books. So I'm like, why not? There must be something in there.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I was growing up, and then I got to the university at a very young age and realized I did not know enough. And so I spent the whole summer reading, just reading, going through. I decided to read the entire literature section of the university library. I was kind of weird. So I started I started alphabetically. Those were the only exceptional, I think, things that happened when I was growing up, yeah.
And when did you first encounter the women's movement?
Well, quite late, actually, quite late. I started as a political activist, a student activist, because the most exclusive organization at the university was the Writers' Club. And you could only go in, you know, if you were unanimously voted in, you know, nobody objected. And that's where all the leftists were. That's where I met he who would become the chairperson of the Communist Party of the Philippines. And so we started learning all of this stuff. Actually, I only got to women and feminism in 1986, which is quite late in my development, when I was able to return home and I wrote a piece on the women's movement in the Philippines for Ms. Magazine. Yeah, they used it as a cover story.
You were a political prisoner under the government of Ferdinand Marcos in the Philippines. I wonder if you can tell me about that. Why were you imprisoned and what was that experience like?
Whoa. In 1972, he declared martial law, and then he had all the media offices, television, you know, newspaper, everything closed. And about 300 men and women of the media arrested. I was, this was what I was told. Of the around 5,000 in the list of people to be arrested, my number had only 2 digits. So I was in the first 100 people listed, primarily because they wanted to control reportage and so on. I spent 6 months in prison. They call it a detention camp, but it's actually a prison inside the military camp. And it was most unpleasant, most uncomfortable, and very, it's like every minute of the day you are in danger. You live in constant tension. I remember that in those 6 months, my sleep was so light, I don't think I even had a single dream. You know, maybe I did, but it didn't make it to my conscious mind, which is most unusual for me because I dream every night. You know, as a writer, my subconscious is always working. And the slightest noise would wake me up. Almost all of us were tortured physically. Some were sexually abused. There was constant psychological harassment and torture. Yeah, 6 months. Yeah.
And do you worry that we're headed in that direction, or not we? I'm in Canada, but you're in the U.S., of course. Do you worry that the U.S. is headed in that direction?
Very much so, especially with the recent happenings in Charlottesville, Virginia, which is very near New York City, where I am. It's only four or five hours away by car. And it's so ironic that the president who has encouraged this was actually born and raised in New York City, which we always pride ourselves in characterizing as a most cosmopolitan, most liberal city. You know, we pass all these laws, removing restrictions on people. But there is an atmosphere of fear, outrage, and helplessness. What does one do? You know, if you're just a woman of color, You know, it's like the everyday sexism and racism we live under, which is the what we call the microaggressions of racism and sexism, have become macroaggressions and really dangerous and threatens everything and all the hours of your day.
Now, you were the founder and first national chair of GabNet, which is a U.S.-based organization supporting the Philippine women's movement, which has since evolved into a firm. Why was it so important to form a specifically U.S. Philippines Women's Solidarity Network?
The our rationale, well, the center of attention at the time in the Philippines was the U.S. military bases. People don't know, but at the time the U.S. kept its largest military bases in the Philippines, and actually under the agreement we were supposed to host 22 military bases. You know, for a small country, that is a huge imposition. And these bases, the Clark Air Force Base and Subic Naval Base, these bases were surrounded by a very dense community, or I don't know if you can call it a community, but a very, very dense area of strip clubs, nightclubs, brothel houses, hotels, and this was serving as magnets, drawing in women from the countryside who did not actually understand what they were getting into, or they were being trafficked from the rural areas to Angeles City and Olongapo City, those two cities. They were called sin cities. And then there was the issue of drugs, and then the beatings, and there were several women who were murdered. One of them was just, not a woman, a girl, a kid, you know. She was, I think, 12 or 13 years old, and she died from an infection because a Marine customer had used a vibrator on her, and it broke off and left pieces in her vaginal canal, and she developed blood poisoning. So this was the biggest question at the time, because the treaty between the United States and the Philippines on this basis was coming to an end. And there were those who wanted to extend it. Of course, the U.S. wanted to extend it, but the Philippines, we wanted the treaty ended and the bases gone. And so there was a very strong women's movement in the Philippines, but it needed international exposure. So I was asked if I would consider helping. So I did.
Great.
And that changed my life completely.
Mm-hmm.
On Wings, you're listening to Ninochka Roska, a founder of the transnational feminist organization known as AFIRM, spelled AF3IRM. The interviewer is Megan Murphy of Feminist Current.
Really? You know, I was an activist from my teenage years, but I've always felt like I didn't come from the class I was advocating for, you know, so there was always a kind of detachment, in, you know, when I look at the work. But with the women's movement, suddenly things which I couldn't understand before became very clear. It was personal.
Mm-hmm. And you're the international spokesperson for AFIRM's Purple Rose campaign, which deals specifically with the trafficking of Filipino women. What is the situation with trafficking in the Philippines today?
It's very difficult to make a distinction between trafficking and prostitution in the Philippines. It's connected to the tourist industry, of course, and it's connected to cyber sex, the cyber sex industry, which centers around the use of children. We are, I hate to use the word Mecca, but we are one of the centers for cyber child prostitution, you know. The last time I was in Cebu, which is an island in central Mindanao, Visayas, the women, they were telling me about how children were used for this. And the customers were mostly Australian, German, people in Europe, American. And sometimes the customer would make an arrangement to come and visit. And that's it. That child is raped, basically. Yeah. So it's difficult to make that distinction. Now, tourism provides roughly 11% of the gross income of the Philippines. So it's a very, very big section of the economy.
And, you know, I'm interested to learn more about the women's movement in the Philippines. What are some key differences between the women's movement in the Philippines and the women's movement in North America? And are there things that Western feminists could learn from Filipina feminists?
This is the situation. It's like this. We had a reproductive health law, which only provides for contraception for the very poor. And that was fought over for 17 years. It was a very mild law. No abortion, no nothing, just contraception. But it couldn't pass Congress for 17 years. It's an indicator of the status of women in the Philippines. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. It's a Catholic country, and it's very macho country. Yeah. There are eternal discussions about whether a man saying, "Hi, babe," to you in the street is catcalling, or he's just being friendly. It's ridiculous. Things that we accept as, you know, this is really an imposition on a woman in Western countries. These are just par for the course of the day for a woman in the Philippines. And then we have this issue with the definition, the legal definition of statutory rape, which is set at the age of 11, which by implication makes the age of consent 12 years old.
Jeez.
Yeah. So in the United States, there is a big difference with the women's movement here. We are also divided, but based largely on ethnicity and color. And it's very hard to cross over, to have a mixed ethnic constituency. But I think we're trying to resolve that now. Affirm is doing that. And there are coalitions all over the place because women are coming to realize that there is no one ethnic community that can carry the changes that we need to effect in the United States.
On that note, the term intersectionality has become really commonplace these days.
Yeah.
It's, you know, like to the point where it's become like a buzzword even, and it's used all the time online, and it's used often by white people to sort of demonstrate politically correct politics, I would say, you know, what's sometimes called virtue signaling. But I'm concerned that many people who do label themselves intersectional in quotations don't really understand what that term means. What does intersectionality mean to you?
Well, it's not simply difference, which is how, by and large, you know, it's vulgar interpretation. I'm different, therefore I'm intersectional. No, that's not it. Ironically, we were the first to like come out and say we are for both transnational and intersectional feminism. And actually, Kimberly Crenshaw marched with us, I think about 3 years ago, during the Million People's March of Black Lives Matter. And we were the only delegation, we and Sister Circle Collective, we were the only delegation who carried the names and photographs of all the black women killed by the police. And so Kimberly was there, and she was marching with us and some other people. And from that came the movement to Say Her Name, the campaign Say Her Name, yeah. But the thing was, intersectionality is a way of analysis. It's a method of analysis. It is a theory of power and power relations, which seldom, this concept seldom appears, yeah, in the rather casual way people use the term. For us, it is understanding our place as a nodal point of interlocking systems of oppression. We call it the trihelix DNA of exploitation in an advanced capitalist society. And this is like race, gender, and class. And we very seldom ever take a position without considering those three aspects. And intersectionality is not a word for individual liberation. It is a word for collective liberation. I think this is what a lot of white women do not understand, and white people in the United States, you know, do not understand. They think intersectionality expresses itself in individualism. It's not. It's a collective. It's a coming together of one's individual position and collective position in society. It's actually locating yourself in the collective, in understanding the collective, which is enduring the same interlocking systems of oppression. So I know people have said you are Western feminist, etc., etc. Well, no, we're not. We look at everything. We look at the economics of it. We look at the politics of it. We look at the social aspect. We try to be very comprehensive. Now, the thing with both transnational feminism and intersectional feminism, these were developed in academia and by academics. Mohanty developed transnational feminism and Kimberly Crenshaw intersectional feminism, although based on actual lived experience. So our task now is to use this as guides, but only as guides in our action on the ground, and then to discard, accept, change aspects and parts of these two perspectives depending on what we experience in our work organizing, educating, and mobilizing women.
One of the things I find really frustrating about Western liberal feminism is its lack of understanding or interest in class and the way that capitalism and patriarchy work together to keep women vulnerable and oppressed. You know, the kind of feminism that we hear about in mainstream media especially is really focused on what celebrities have to say about so-called feminism.
Mm-hmm.
And what's so great about Affirm is that you have such a strong analysis of how these various systems of power intersect. And those who talk about intersectionality in the U.S. often still don't criticize pop culture and mainstream media and the sex trade and the beauty industry and all these things totally rooted in capitalism and corporatism. How do you see things like capitalism, colonialism, imperialism contributing to women's oppression in the real world? You know, how should we be looking at feminism and women's rights mm-hmm. within those contexts?
Well, Affirm has a requirement, a very strict requirement about study. So we study, and so we don't start with capitalism. You know, we actually start with the rise of class. And I think this is what is lacking in the public's understanding of what feminism is and how women's oppression is related to the concepts of private property and class evolution, you know, the evolution of class. We have a four-hour discussion on the creation of patriarchy by Lerner. You know, the whole book is required reading. So we at least understand how it is that in every class society, women are oppressed. I think that's the very fundamental thing that we need to understand first of all. Because capitalism does not exist historically, independent of its historical evolution. And so it carries forward all of the traditions and concepts which enabled class to develop and survive. So that's one thing, that's the first. And then second, we are women of color. We call ourselves transnational women because we come from lands and cultures which had experienced colonialism and which are now experiencing imperialism with its use of corruption and the local oligarchy to maintain its power over these lands, you know.
That book Roska mentioned as important to study is The Creation of Patriarchy by historian Gerda Lerner. Tune in next week to hear more about the transnational women of color feminist organization Affirm from the group's instigator Ninochka Roska and in a fiery speech by Affirm's national chairperson Ivy Kicho. Thanks to Megan Murphy and Feminist Current for use of this audio. You can find more of their media at feministcurrent.com. To hear this and other Wings programs again, check our searchable new website, wingsradio.org, or email us, wings@wings.org. Wings thanks all our supporters, including your local community radio station, Suzette Cullen, and Genevieve Vaughn, whose books include Homo Donans and Women and the Gift Economy. The Wings sound logo is from Libana's album, A Circle is Cast. I'm Frieda Worden. This is the Women's International News Gathering Service.